Happy Rahatsu. I'm really quite sort of amazed that we're doing this. There's a really tremendous number of conditions that have to be present, it seems like, to have a Sesshin that feels like Sesshin. Whatever that is supposed to feel like, but it does. We have to have some kind of tradition that we have enough faith in to work with it and tweak it and interpret it in the many ways that we have to. You know, and think if we didn't start from that, you know, how many committee meetings would it take to figure this out, you know? We'd have like a, you know, Zendo protocol committee and a meal form committee and a, you know, signals, the signals subcommittee. But more, and so that seems like an important condition that somehow is present. But also we need the condition of having all of us here and having. It seems to be essential to have people who have practiced for quite a while, some of whom have been to many Sesshin, and also to have people who haven't been to so many Sesshin also seems to be important. And we need a place to do it and a quiet day. You could kind of make a really long list, so I'm really quite amazed and quite grateful that we get to do this together. The word Sesshin, usually at the orientation in English-speaking Zendos, they tell you the word Sesshin, which is formed of two characters. The first is actually sets. The T gets dropped when it gets combined, I guess. Sets, S-E-T-S-U. And the second is Shin. S-H-I-N, which we see in a lot of things. So Shin means heart or mind. They use the same word. Not the heart, the pump, but the, you know, metaphorical heart. The heart of the matter, the heart of our life. And we, you know, in Western languages, we sort of privilege the intellect, right? And so we put the mind off in its own word, but in Asian cultures, it's the same word, Shin. And they always tell you that sets means gather, to gather the mind. So that makes some kind of sense, right? We feel scattered, so we better take some time and sort of like pull things back together into this little package, you know? But at Loon Lake Sesshin, when she was doing the orientation, Kate said, who knows enough Japanese to look things up, she said she finally looked this up. She was always a little suspicious of that. You know, it didn't sound right. And she looked it up, and it turns out to be wrong. I don't know how many thousands of English-speaking Zendos they've told you it means that, but now we know a new thing. She says it means to touch, which actually makes a lot more sense if you think about it. Because what is there really to gather? I mean, how would you... like? We did, it was lovely the way Bob added the new form, if you weren't here, during the Rohatsu ceremony. These flowers sort of just appeared, like from the Tushita heaven, I think, is where they come from. And so we had a little temple cleaning time, and Bob introduced the form of, for the cleaning, we picked up the flowers one by one by hand, very mindfully, you know. So that you can gather flowers, I suppose, but how do you gather the mind? How do you gather the heart? And so maybe we can forget about trying to gather anything. You know, a little bit more, just let the chips fall where they may, not to try to control all these funny aspects and facets of personality, of mind, of our being, not try to gather them or control them or organize them or improve them at all. Just leave them alone and reach right through them and touch the heart of the matter. Touch the center of our life instead. and trust that all those things we're trying to gather will sort themselves out without our interference, you know, without our super smart attempt to organize them. Because we know how that works out, right? And it's interesting having this tradition that comes through Japan, because we have all of these sort of layers of language and meaning. In a way, they're like these little treasures, you know, waiting to be discovered. And so now, 50 years into the American Zen experiment, we discover this little treasure that we were holding all this time of seishin, to touch the mind. But there's lots more. We could go on just about a few words for the whole talk easily. Like Shin, for instance, turns out to be the Japanese way of saying, the Chinese way of saying a Chinese character. But in everyday Japanese, you wouldn't say Shin. You say Kokoro. And how they got from the Chinese something like Jin to Shin, that's not too big of a leap. But then how did they get to Kokoro? Some whole other story, full of meaning, I'm sure. And likewise, when we chanted the names of the Zen ancestors in the ceremony, which is usually in sort of formal Soto Zen temples in Japan, that would be done every morning, but here we just do it once a year for various reasons. So that's also the Japanese way of saying, you know, Sanskrit and Pali and Chinese names, and now here we are trying to pronounce it. And probably if somebody walked in here from Japan, they have no idea what we're talking about. That's all right, you know, that's what we received. And just like gathering the mind, we don't need to straighten it all out. We can just work with it, tweaking a little bit, you know. So likewise, Rohatsu has meaning. But it has a pretty pedestrian meaning, it turns out. Ro means the 12th month of the year. And Hatsu is just the number 8. So the Buddha's enlightenment is celebrated on the 8th day of the 12th month. And in Japan, so that would have been a lunar, on the lunar calendar in China. And in Japan, towards the end of the 18th century, they did this high-speed modernization and westernization. They switched the Gregorian calendar. And so now we celebrate it on the 8th of December. But of course, it isn't actually the 8th of December, is it? It's the 5th of December. So we are also accommodating the weekday schedule. Maybe we couldn't all take, what would that be, Tuesday or Wednesday? Maybe we couldn't take that day off and sit all day. So there's many layers of story and meaning here. All of it, I suppose, is to some extent made up. But it seems to be a fact of the human sort of cultural and mythological mind that if you make something up and we all believe in it and put some energy into it, it becomes very real and very important. So here we are, you know, in our made-up Zendo on a made-up Rohatsu. And Zen Buddhists all over the world are doing the same thing. This is like the high holy days of Zen, the big occasion for the year. And then the most formal way to celebrate a Rohatsu, maybe you already know, is you do like a sort of a 7-day and a little more seishin. You start on the 1st of December, and you do what we're doing today, but day after day for 7 days. And then on the evening of the 7th, you sit up all night. You sit up all night to enact the central story of today, the story of Sakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, which, as you know, the story culminates, the great heroic story culminates in an epic night of all-night practice, or maybe it was 7 nights of practice, I don't know, but there's a key final night when, after working through many, many confusions and delusions and layers and all this, Buddha sort of finished waking up in the morning when he saw the morning star. And so what's kind of great is we know that right now, this very moment, in Zen temples and centers all over the world, people are sitting in Sesshin, trying to touch their heart, trying to clarify their life. And we actually know one of these monks. Chris Burkhardt is right now at 7-day Sesshin at Green Gulch Farm. So like the fourth or fifth day of Sesshin for her. So we support her and we support all the other practitioners and we are supported by them. And so this story of Buddha's enlightenment and the 2,500 years on our calendar between now and that moment seemingly long ago is also a story of lineage, a story of ancestors, a story of those who came before. And so that long list of names, that's what that was. Of course, you couldn't understand a single one of them probably, but that's what that was. And it wasn't even just starting with Buddha. Buddha was the eighth name on the list. Before that were mythical Buddhas, even before that Buddha. Because Indian time is not linear like ours, it's cyclical. And in the way Buddhism was understood in the beginning, there have been many ages with Buddhas. Every age has a Buddha, and then the decline, and then, you know, so it's a cyclical thing. But we got to Buddha, and we got to his first enlightened disciple, Mahakashyapa, Makakasho Dayosho, and his enlightened disciple, according to the Zen way of looking at things, Ananda Dayosho, and all the way down to Suzuki Roshi, who was the last name on the list, where we said, Shogaku Shunryu Dayosho. And all Buddhist schools emphasize lineage and ancestors to different extents. Definitely all Buddhists honor and study certain key teachers in their lineage, reading and commenting over and over and over again on key works. So in a way, Buddhism is just sort of a continuous reinvestigation and rediscovery of the same teachings, each generation seeing them in the way that they see them. And so there are books and teachings and history we can learn, for sure. But Zen Buddhism particularly strongly emphasizes a sort of lovely myth of student to teacher, generation after generation, in an unbroken line going back to Buddha. So that's the other symbolism of the list that we chanted. They say that the teachings can't just be learned in a book, that they're outside words and letters, which is a teaching. This outside words and letters is a teaching attributed to Bodhidharma, which was definitely made up in the 11th century. So that's how that can go. But it's true. Bodhidharma also said it, see? And so this is a powerful story. And it's practically and obviously true. You have to meet other practitioners and work with teachers to really appreciate the possibilities and depth of practice. They also say that Buddha's way can only be passed from warm hand to warm hand. But like all stories and mythologies, it's also a little problematic. One of the reasons why we don't chant that list every time we have early practice Besides the sort of bits of historical fiction that we know of that are embedded in that list, the Indian ancestors are particularly suspect. I guess India, in early Buddhism India, they didn't particularly think about things in terms of a linear lineage. So the Chinese guys had to go back and reverse engineer. But it's also a list of men, of only men. And we know that from the time of Buddha, there were women practitioners. And so there's no way this could have been passed on without many women involved. It's not really possible. And so we could work hard to invent our own, reverse engineer our own women's list of women, too. And they did that in a limited way at San Francisco Zen Center under Norman's supervision. And maybe we'll chant that list sometime, too. But that's equally made up. And equally perfect. All these stories. And as we study the mind in Zazen, we realize, little by little, that we too are just a story. But why our story can be so difficult for us is we're not really in charge of it. We're just one factor in the invention of our own story. And so we end up with very ungainly stories. Personalities that we carry around with some things that we like embedded in them. But we seem to always get a personality with all these little things sort of sticking out that we don't like. And the little things that are sticking out of our personality seem to have a way of whacking into other people's little projections, resulting in a lot of suffering. And so you might think that Zen practice is like a way that we could rub together and sort of smooth off all that stuff, so we could just be shining, graceful, beautiful Buddha beings. And that's true in a way. That's true in a way. It does happen. Practice does help us. But in another way, it's not true at all. This personality, this container, was created by conditions far beyond our control. And these tendencies that we have that bother us, we will definitely have until we die, and maybe lifetimes after that. But what Zen practice can do so beautifully, and I think is its most important contribution to the human life, is it can help us shift our attitude and understanding of this spiky personality that we have to carry around. We can understand our tendencies and our unwholesome, problematic qualities as just the conditions of our life. It's just the hand we were dealt. Ours to work with as best we can. And we can absolutely remove the incredible amount of extra energy and suffering and anguish and guilt and disturbance that we add on top of all that. When we bump into people with our little spiky parts, we can learn to say we're sorry, to understand a little more clearly, and let it go. We can really change the context of our life, and we can experience this directly through Zazen practice and through Sesshin practice. We can really see the way it goes with mind and conditions and who we think we are. It's real hard. I feel like I'm stumbling a little bit. It's hard to quite explain this with words. Maybe you know what I'm talking about anyway. Zen practice is not going to fix you. Because that you is not a you that can or should be fixed. But Zen practice can support you in understanding more clearly the nature of this being and this living, and then it's not such a problem. But anyway, let's talk about Buddha. That's what we're supposed to do. Sorry, that was a long discursion. I apologize for the coats. It's looking bad. That was a long side road there. So you're supposed to talk about Buddha, Arahatsu Sesshin. So I'll attempt to fulfill my brief here. Because Buddha's story is great, isn't it? The story of this, the hero's journey. The most famous and popular story in Western culture, and apparently pretty popular in Eastern culture too, where it came from. Or India's, sort of both in a way. The story of a quest. And it fits so into our idea of how things are supposed to go. Heroes have to go on quests. They have to work hard, they have to go through lots of problems, and they have to emerge at the end, somehow renewed and changed. And we've been telling these stories forever. The earliest known stories from Babylon, right, are stories of the hero's journey. And Luke Skywalker's great quest to rid the galaxy of the evil empire helps us carry on this great tradition. So I'm sure you remember how this story got started. A young prince, who I guess historically wasn't really a prince, but young man in an important family in a small sort of city-state, is sheltered by his father. I don't know what his mother thought about this. They never say about that, do they? This is always his father who's doing all this. She died at birth, that's why, yeah. And what did his stepmother think? Yeah, Mahaprajapati, what did she think? Right, mom died, so we don't talk too much about mom. Which is interesting because there's this massive cult of the Virgin Mary, right? Like one of the most important people in Catholicism is the mother of Jesus, but the mother of Buddha we don't talk about too much. Yeah, so. So anyway, he cruises along for some years and then has some experiences outside the palace of seeing the way life really goes. Seeing sickness, old age, and death. And we also know that it doesn't necessarily go in that order or in any order. Today's Sesshin is also a kind of memorial Sesshin for four people who've died recently. So we know that death comes anytime, by lots of ways. I was reading a book by Dalai Lama, and he was reminding us there are only a few conditions that will sustain and allow life, and there are many, many conditions that end life. So he really encourages us to be mindful with this precious life. So anyway, the young prince, young Buddha, is so shocked by this, as we have been lately, that he can't go on. He really can't go on with his life the way he's been living it. He has to abandon everything and begin his heroic journey, leaving home to do nothing but spiritual practice until he could figure out how could anybody live. How could there be any joy or even any life in the face of this horrible situation. And the story goes on, as you know, that time after time, he was wandering around seeking out the best spiritual teachers he could find, which is what we would do too, right? We would start off on our quests and we'd go visiting different teachers and different centers, maybe taking workshops in our case. So he did that. Time after time, meeting a teacher, practicing very assiduously in a very smart, skillful way, like he's the best student, you know? He was like the ideal practitioner. Time after time, mastering the teachings of each teacher. And they don't usually tell you sort of calendar time in these stories, but seemingly pretty quickly, you know, pretty quickly. And then what happens over and over again is each teacher would like offer him a job. Go, oh, you want to, you know, work here? You want to sit? And one of them said, why don't you just take over? I'll sit over there, you sit here. Yeah, one of the important teachers like got the teachings from his father, never felt like he really understood it anyway. And Buddha came along and he understood it, you know, better than he, you know. But the young Buddha-to-be, was not satisfied with that either. Because as subtle and sublime and important as those meditative experiences and yogic experiences were, he understood that they were also only conditioned states. Only things that could arise on the basis of his effort, and because of that, temporary. You could stay in your meditative absorption for a day, or a week sometime, according to the Pali Canon. We would probably be committing you if you did that, but but then eventually you come out of it, and you're back to where you were with the same problem. How can anyone be happy or content in the face of how things are? How could it be that our member and friend Mark Livingston, a big, quiet, sweet, humble man who loved his family, loved to come sit when he could, usually came at noon, and he helped a lot with the work, too, he liked to work. How could it be that he would just one day, in a couple of days, get sick and die and be gone? How can that make any sense? And how can we go about our business like everything's fine? Everything is not fine. And we, of course, remember that sometimes too. And we don't really know quite what to do about that feeling. So we mostly just try to move along and think about something else. But the story of Buddha is a story of somebody who could not put that down, even for a moment. Burning from that, with that question, with that problem. The weight of suffering is just so heavy. And the story of Buddha lays out nicely in chapters, like any good story does. So after that period, he and a few of his sort of practice buddies figured they probably just weren't trying hard enough. That was probably the problem. So they set off out into the forest, they say, to practice hard, like really hard. Like, you know, I apologize. I meant to apologize earlier. There wasn't really any break after breakfast, but I don't think the Buddha and his buddies took breaks after breakfast. In fact, they didn't have breakfast. They tried all kinds of extreme. So, you know, it's good for us to have breaks, and we'll adjust the schedule for next time to have more of a break. But the other great thing about Sesshin is that, and this was true of how the Buddha was practicing, is everything is completely included and important to our practice. There's sort of no mistakes in Sesshin. So the schedule being a little wonky and having no break and all of us having to say, oh my God, what? Only 5 minutes? You know? Or whatever it is, however it was reacted. And that's just more practice for us. Something to study. Something to work with. So anyway, the Buddha and his buddies set out, and here is the Buddha describing later some of the things they tried. And I think a lot, I don't know where they got all these practices. Maybe they were just sort of in the culture, or maybe they made some of this up. So I think this is after quite a while of eating like one grain of rice or something like that a day. Then he said, and then I thought, suppose I were to become absorbed in the trance of non-breathing. Like, yeah, basically breathing's a bit soft, you know? We do not emphasize this practice, by the way, before I go on. So I stopped the in-breaths and the out-breaths in my nose and mouth. You know, and it says something, too, about this sort of level of concentration that they developed. You know, they could do this. You know, they could say, okay. And as I did this, there was a loud roaring of winds coming out of my ear holes. Just like the loud roar of winds coming out of a smith's bellows. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths in my nose and my mouth and my ears. You know. And as I did this, extreme forces sliced through my head. Just as if a strong man were slicing my head open with a sharp sword. That's what it felt like. Extreme pains arose in my head, just as if a strong man was tightening a turban made of tough leather straps around my head. So you can imagine him standing behind you. And then extreme forces carved up my stomach cavity, just as if a butcher or his apprentice were to carve the stomach cavity of an ox. And then there was an extreme burning in my body, just as if two strong men, so now we need two strong men, just as if two strong men grabbing a weaker man by the arms were to roast and broil him over a pit of embers. And although tireless persistence was aroused in me, so he was motivated by this somehow, and, you know, like, okay, you know, I can bear this. Think about this the next time you're ready to move your legs in zazen. And then, you know, move your legs, but think about it for a moment. And so a tireless persistence was aroused in me, and unmuddled mindfulness was established. So he could stay with this, you know, he could really stay with this strong experience. My body was aroused, but my body was aroused and uncalm because of this painful exertion. But the painful feeling that arose in this way did not invade my mind or remain. So then he could stop and let this go. Try something else. But then, this is really the best part of the story. After doing this for quite a while, these kind of things, and there's a lot of them. You can read the Pali Canon sometime. You know, standing in cold lakes, and, you know, everything. Then he said, then I thought he remembered something. He remembered something important from his childhood. And to me, this is really pivotal. Sometimes it seems like practice is really just about remembering something that we've forgotten. He said, I recall that once when my father, the Sakyan, was working, and other stories say it was kind of like a harvest, plowing festival, they're out in the fields. My father was working in the fields, and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree. And then, quite secluded from sensuality, secluded from unskillful mental qualities, I entered and remained in the first meditative absorption. Rapture and pleasure born from seclusion, was accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. So he remembered one time as a boy, maybe 10 or 11, just the conditions were right somehow. Just sitting by himself. Usually he's sort of the center of attention, but he was sitting by himself. On a beautiful day. Very still. You know, not reading or anything. Just spontaneously entering into a very beautiful, calm state. So later he's thinking, could that be the path to awakening? And then following on that memory came a realization. That is the path to awakening. So why, and then he thinks to himself, so why am I afraid of that pleasure which has nothing to do with sensuality and nothing to do with unskillful mental qualities? So in other words, one of the motivators for them in their ascetic period was the complete avoidance of all pleasure. You know, sort of raised on pleasure, that didn't work, so now I'm going to renounce pleasure. So now he's realizing, well, there's different kinds of pleasure. Some kinds of pleasure are wholesome. And then I thought, I'm no longer afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensuality and nothing to do with unskillful mental qualities. But that pleasure is not easy to achieve. Not easy to achieve. Especially not with the body extremely emaciated. So this is the beginnings of the middle way here, right? You realize that's a subtle sort of wholesome pleasure, and I can't experience that if my body's miserable. So suppose I were to take some solid food, some rice and porridge. So I took some solid food, some rice and porridge, and the five monks that had been practicing with me were then thought, misreading. So the five, he's been with five practice buddies, and they really respect him. And they had been thinking, if Gautama, our contemplative, achieves some higher state, he will tell us. So he's sort of the leader of the group, I guess. And they were thinking, you know, if he figures out the best practice, I'm sure he'll tell us. But then they saw me taking solid food, rice and porridge, and they were disgusted and left, thinking, ah, Gautama, the contemplative, is living luxuriously now. He has abandoned the way and is backsliding into abundance. But, you know, it's probably not such a big bowl of porridge, but it's more than a grain of rice. So it could be that all of us have a memory like that of sitting under the rose apple tree and really feeling and understanding in our bones contentment and connection, and that everything really is fine just the way it is. And that we can return to that with our practice. So it's a wonderful story. And then, of course, the young Buddha to be sets out to essentially sit zazen. Or every Buddhist tradition now says, now he does what we do, you know. Now he does our practice. He figured it out, you know. And just to be open, radically accepting whatever arises, sitting under a beautiful tree, by a river, gently engaging whatever came his way, and having an epic battle through the night with all the remaining confusions and misunderstandings that arose until victoriously emerging, you know, with a clear understanding of the way things go and how to end suffering for himself and for all beings. So that's a wonderful story. But like all stories, it's also a kind of a source of confusion and a bit of a trap. On the one hand, if we embrace Buddha's story, this heroic story, and set off to follow in his footsteps, how do we stack up? Are we that good? Maybe if we tried harder. Or we might reject this story, embedded as it is with confusion, with sexism. For one thing, he abandoned his wife and baby to set out on this quest. For another thing that's very confusing in the story is, after his full awakening, at first he didn't really want to teach anybody. Did you know that? Later Buddhists had a really hard time with this part of the story. He figured like nobody would get it, basically. And so he was at first just going to sort of hang out in that state, I suppose, until the body was no longer living. Somebody, a sort of divine being, had to like emerge from the heavens and like talk him into it. So there are also lots of problems with the story. And of course, the second important problem with the story for women is after he'd established the monastic order, and there are a few dozen monks, all men, practicing with him, his stepmother and many other women from their community came to ask him if they could ordain too and be full practitioners in the order. And he didn't want to do that. He thought that was a bad idea. We don't really know what he was thinking. It doesn't explain it. But again, someone had to like sort of talk him into it. His cousin and attendant, Ananda, had to like talk him into it. So if we were looking for someone who was perfect, we're not going to find that. If we were looking for a way to abdicate our responsibility for our own life and find someone else to follow, there is going to be trouble. On the other hand, if we don't embrace some story of redemption, some story of a life beyond confusion, we'll just hang out in our own shit, right? So somehow we need to work with a story on both sides. The perfect story of awakening and another story of human confusion and the endless work of bodhisattvas to clarify and love the whole world. So I got one more story for you, and I'll try to wrap it up so the cooks can finish lunch. It's a whole different kind of story from the Zen tradition a little bit later. This is case 3 from the Book of Serenity. The case is, a Raja of an East Indian country invited the 27th Buddhist patriarch, and here they honestly say patriarch, Buddhist ancestor, Prajnatara, to a feast. So a Raja of an East Indian country invited the 27th Buddhist ancestor, Prajnatara, to a feast. And then the Raja asked him, why don't you read scriptures? Prajnatara said, this poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in the realms of body or mind when breathing in, doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances when breathing out. I always reiterate such a scripture, hundreds, thousands, millions of scrolls. So the king, the Raja, asks important Buddhist teacher, who was on the list that we chanted, by the way. This is the teacher of Bodhidharma in the Zen way of thinking of things, Prajnatara. So the king asked him, why don't you, you know, read scriptures and give learned talks? And, you know, I guess he'd noticed that this guy was not like giving lots of lectures and stuff. Why don't you tell us about the scriptures? And Prajnatara said, this poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in the realms of body or mind when breathing in, doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances when breathing out. I always reiterate such a scripture, hundreds, thousands, millions of scrolls. So this is exactly Sesshin practice instructions, isn't it? Forget about stories. Now we're saying, here's a story about forgetting about stories. Forget about teachings. Just breathe. And really engage with breathing. Understand that breathing in is releasing. pulling yourself in, not dwelling anywhere, on breathing in, not dwelling anywhere, not needing to be anywhere, not needing to be anybody, just breathing in. And breathing out, not getting involved in that world out there. And then in the commentary to the case, the compiler references some more specific teachings about breath practice. So I meant to look up, but I think this is from the 9th or 10th century in China. So this is pretty old, you know. And in this teaching, there are 6 suggestions for how to practice breath practice. So I want to share these with you because we can try this. And the first is counting the breath. So see, we didn't make that up for Americans. Very old. Very venerable practice. I'm sure you've all gotten these instructions before. And the inhalation to energize the body, to be present. And the exhalation to feel the dropping of the diaphragm, the falling away of everything, and to count. 1. Or I suppose they probably count it in Chinese, though. Inhalation, and to count 2. To feel the breathing, and to mark each exhalation with the number. So we shouldn't think of this as a beginner's practice or something sort of added on because we don't get it, but as an ancient and important central practice from the tradition. And to do nothing but breath counting for our whole lives would be great. And then the second one they mention is following the breath. So if breath counting, I'm sorry, Terry and Diane, you probably better go. Thank you very much. I'll tell you the rest later. So if the numbers, concentration is well established, and numbers seem sort of superfluous and unnecessary, to let the numbers just fade to nothing, let the numbers disappear, and just follow the breath. And they don't explicate that it's there, but Norman has also suggested there's 2 different ways. One is to follow the breath pretty clearly right in the center of the body, the rising and falling of the diaphragm, the hara. It's one way. So you can try that. Very grounding, very simple practice. Or to follow the breathing as it fills the entire body and releases from the entire body. Feel the inhalation, and you can expand that even to feel sort of the whole room, the whole world. Breathing in fills the whole world. Breathing out releases everything into the earth. So counting, and then following. And then the next one they mention is stopping, which is not what the Buddha did, not stopping the breathing. It's to where the awareness of breathing becomes increasingly subtle. And that too sort of fades to nothing. And you can't exactly make this practice happen. You just stay calmly and evenly with following the breath, and sometimes it might just fade to nothing, and that's stopping. And then the next one, so counting, following, stopping. The next one they talk about is inquiry. Inquiry. Once the breath is very subtle and calm, to sort of turn towards the experience of living, of sitting and breathing, with sort of a feeling of, what is this? Feeling of discovery, feeling of inquiry. Sometimes you might take up a phrase to work with, and you can work with a teacher to have a phrase, you want a phrase. Bring up the sort of wonder, you know, the mystery of breathing. And I'm so much over time, I'm not even going to tell you the other two, but that's enough. That's enough. So maybe inspired by Shakyamuni Buddha's heroic story on Rahatsu, we can abandon that story. And as we abandon that story, maybe we can set down our own story. And just join Prajnatara in breathing. And working with it, and maybe in one of the ways I mentioned, or maybe you have another way that you're already working with breathing. Not dwelling when breathing out. Not involved. Sorry, not dwelling when breathing in. Not dwelling anywhere. Breathing out. We have this opportunity of the container of Sesshin for as long as each of us is here. So let's enjoy that for the rest of the day. Thank you very much for your patient attention. I never particularly feel like I'm